much of this inside. What I'm going to be doing this evening, the title of the talk is Networking, the Politics of the Elders of Oil. Now, that title obviously refers to, it's a slight corruption of the title of a viciously anti-Semitic document called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was an anti-Semitic forgery put together by the Tsarist secret police in Tsarist Russia. And the thing that occasioned the title of this talk, and it's also, by the way, the title of For the Record 334, and also of number 337, which is two broadcasts off. By the way, I see at least one gentleman standing in the back. Maybe come in the front, and we have at least one empty chair here, and another one there. How many of you have empty chairs adjacent to you? Hold your hands up. Okay, so because there are some people who can sit on what you're supposed to sit on, and that's going to be a hell of a lot more comfortable than sitting on what you're going to find yourself sitting on post-September 11th, in many cases, I'm afraid. So if there's anybody in the back kneeling or with your relatively soft bottoms on the very hard floor, there have been some chairs here, and we'll see. Maybe I can surrender, since I'm going to have to be clever and wonderful. If we get a chance to play it, we'll see. I mean, the guy who's supposed to be taping this ain't here. So we'll see how things work. Anyway, the title refers to some of the power politics that are taking place. It is only one dimension of the events that took place on September 11th. As I've said, the authorship of this event, and I was convinced of it from the beginning, and I can all but prove it now, is what I call the Underground Reich. At its economic level, the Bormann Organization. At its political level, a Nazi party and a Third Reich that went underground and that has links to many, many things, including Islamic extremists. There is a book that I've been talking about for quite some time on the program. It is, I believe, the equivalent of Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography and political manifesto in which he pretty much predicted what he was going to be doing. That book is called Serpent's Walk. It's published by National Vanguard Books, which is the publishing arm of the National Alliance, the most important domestic American Nazi group. That's redundant, but what the hell. The National Alliance has also published The Turner Diaries, which also, I believe, like Serpent's Walk, is in fact not the novel it purports to be, but a blueprint, a manifesto for what has taken place and what is going to take place. Serpent's Walk is about the Third Reich and the SS going underground at the end of World War II, forming a huge economic organization, infiltrating the U.S. Army, buying into and gaining control of the American opinion-forming media, and following a biological warfare attack on the United States, martial law is declared, and they move in and they take over the United States. A number of things led me to suspect, primarily having read about the Bormann Organization, that this was in fact what was taking place, and a lot of people, when I began talking about Serpent's Walk, basically said I had a dick growing out of my head. They didn't want to hear about it. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem that far removed now. I would note, in the wake of September 11th, and we're going to, in a sense, start with the future, talk a little bit about the present, then we're going to go into the past, and I'm going to try to work a timeline up from events that took place in the Middle East in the 1930s and involve the politics of the Elders of Oil right on up through today. One of the things that happened as a result of the 9/11 tax is a precipitous drop in American media stocks because many American media outlets were providing around-the-clock coverage of the events of September 11th. They lost a tremendous amount of advertising revenue. Disney's stock went down roughly 6% in one day. As a result of this, one of the two German companies with strong Third Reich links, which now completely control, for all intents and purposes, American publishing, English language publishing, is Bertelsmann. It's the third largest media company in the world. It was founded by Heinrich Mohn, who was SS. Some of the Bertelsmann efforts include funding the Himmler Kreis, or Himmler Circle of Friends, which funded the workings of the day-to-day workings of the SS in the Third Reich's underground period. And among the other companies that did that was the Hamburg America Line, which was one of four Bush family companies that was confiscated by the Alien Property Custodian in World War II as Nazi front companies. Another of those companies was the Union Banking Corporation, which was a joint Bush family Thyssen venture. That's actually the correct pronunciation of T-H-Y-S-S-E-N, which is a German, a Dutch name. The Dutch, I'm told, pronounce Y's like U's, and the Germans pronounce double S like a Z, so it's actually pronounced Thyssen. But the Bush family fortune comes from the post-war liquidation of the Union Banking Corporation. The Bushes were well off before that, but they got $1.8 million in cash in 1951, which was a lot more money than it is today. From the post-war liquidation of the Union Banking Corporation, Union Banking Corporation is undoubtedly a Bormann company, and its post-war liquidation in partnership with the Thyssen family must necessarily have taken place in conjunction with the Bormann organization. The Bush family, in my estimation, are the point element for the Bormann organization in the United States. And I would note that Bertelsmann has a huge cash war chest. They have some $4.7 billion available for corporate takeovers, which are now easier as a result of September 11th, because American media stocks have dropped. I would also note that a deal which was viewed as a really poor business deal when it took place, which was Bertelsmann's sale of AOL Europe, is now looking like one of the deals of the century. As a result of selling AOL Europe for stock, Bertelsmann is going to be getting perhaps as much as $6.7 billion, that's billion dollars, including $2.5 billion in cash. So basically, Bertelsmann is poised to rake in the American media acquisitions. Someone who might suspect that the company has strayed from its SS roots should be aware, as I've spoken about on the air, that the company's historian, their house historian, a guy named Dirk Bobendam, published books in 1983, 1994, and 1998, which blamed World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, on Jewish control of the American media, and on Zionism and on the United States. Very, very interesting take on world history. It's not really all that different from the version of events that has been presented by the Al-Qaeda supporters worldwide. That is the future. I believe that is what is going to take place, unless this train of events is interdicted. I would suggest that listeners do everything humanly possible to communicate as much of the information that is available, as much of the information that I've made available as possible, to as many people as possible in hopes of perhaps bringing a halt to this chain of events. Now, I'm going to talk briefly about the present or immediate past and outline a few of the elements that we're going to be talking about. Then I'm going to go back to the history of the Middle East in the 1930s and try to trace some of the politics of the elders of oil through history, and so that perhaps some of the dots that I'm going to be connecting here will be more firmly connected in people's minds. One of the things to understand about the fighting in Afghanistan is this is the second major war that's taken place, of course, in Afghanistan in the recent decades. The first one took place following the former Soviet Union's invasion in 1979. One of the central elements in the anti-Soviet Afghan war that was being pursued by the U.S., by the intelligence community of the U.S., by the intelligence community of the United Kingdom, and by the Saudi government and by the Pakistanis, was an organization called the World Muslim Congress, or WMC. Those of you who are taking notes will want to note that institution. It is very closely allied with the former World Anti-Communist League. It could be accurately described as Islamo-fascist. That organization, funded in considerable measure by the Saudi royal family, sent Holocaust denial literature to every member of the United States Congress and the British Parliament. The Saudi government, by the way, hired in the 1980s an American neo-Nazi named William Grimstead as their Washington lobbyist representative. And the World Muslim Congress, again, which was a major element in the anti-Soviet Afghan war, was founded by a guy named Haj Amin al-Husseini, or the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. This guy was the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement. He also was a major in the SS and recruited a number of Muslim Waffen-SS divisions for the Third Reich. including the 13th Waffen-SS Division, or Hanjar Division, composed of Bosnian Muslims, one of whose members as a young man was Alija Izetbegović, the current president of Bosnia, Bosnia-Herzegovina now being an epicenter for al-Qaeda operations in Europe. Another thing to remember about the first Afghan war is that it was this conflict that saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden as a warrior. That's where he got his start as a guerrilla warrior. It's also where he used equipment from his family's very prestigious construction business to help build some of the underground installations and fortifications that are apparently going to be some of the mountain redoubts for al-Qaeda fighters in the ongoing hostilities. It's worth remembering that, and we're going to come back to this, that the Bush family and the bin Laden family are by no means strangers. In the immediate aftermath of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the bin Laden family removed their capital participation in something called the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group is a very prestigious, very wealthy international investment firm, one of whose subsidiaries specializes in military takeovers. It was capitalized in part by the bin Laden family. And one of the major consultants, paid consultants for a Carlyle Group, is the elder George Bush, as is James Baker, George Bush's former Secretary of State. It's also worth remembering that the younger George Bush also got a consultancy fee from Carlyle Group, and again, that was capitalized in considerable measure by the bin Laden family. By the way, the bin Laden family are extremely wealthy. They got their business, their money from building in Saudi Arabia, and of course that money in turn comes from oil. The bin Laden family are also heavily involved. Well, the North American business representative of the bin Laden family, a guy named James R. Bath, helped to capitalize George W.'s first oil company, Arbusto Energy. People who knew him at the time said that he didn't have much money of his own, and that the money, in all likelihood, that helped to capitalize Arbusto Energy probably came from his wealthy Saudi clients, including the bin Mahfouz family, connected not only to the BCCI, but one of the al-Qaeda funding branches, a Saudi-based charity called the Muwafaq Foundation. That's called M-U-W-A-F-A-Q. That's not a name you want to mispronounce on the air, by the way. And the one of the major elements involved with the Muwafaq Foundation, an alleged al-Qaeda funding conduit, is the bin Mahfouz family, for whom James R. Bath was also the North American business representative. James R. Bath, again, was alleged by people who knew him to not have much money of his own, so in all probability, the money that helped to capitalize George W.'s first oil company came from, in part at least, the bin Laden family. And it should also be noted, in the immediate aftermath of the attacks, the bin Laden family, who had a number of representatives in the United States, were flown out of the United States on a Saudi government jet, or a Saudi government chartered private jet, before they could be questioned by the FBI. The bin Laden family's geographical epicenter in the United States, and they are very wealthy, was again Boston, the city of Boston, from which the two planes that crashed into the World Trade Center took off. The bin Laden women in the United States and other members of the family are noted for their love of flying. They are registered and licensed pilots. One wonders whether they've ever been involved with training other people to fly airplanes, not necessarily to land them. Again, that's conjecture. What is not conjecture is that before the FBI could question members of the bin Laden family, again, with business connections to both Georges Bush, they were flown out of the United States by the Saudi government. So remember the World Muslim Congress, its connection to the first Afghan war against the Soviets. Remember who founded it. The first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, Haj Amin al-Husseini, a key Axis operative, a major himself in the SS. Remember who financed that in part. It's strongly connected with Pakistan. It's financed by the Saudi government and the Saudi royal family. And remember the Bush family, bin Laden family business connections. Those go through Arbusto Energy and James R. Bath and the bin Laden family. By the way, Salem M. bin Laden, who was the fellow who was hooked up with James R. Babb. He died in a plane crash in 1988, right at the time the elder George Bush was running for president and the Iran-Contra affair was being investigated. His father also died of in a plane crash as well. But remember, Arbusto Energy, James R. Babb, and the Bin Laden family. Remember Carlyle Group and their connections to the Bin Laden family and also to the elder George Bush and the younger George Bush and to James Baker. On October 26th, it was announced that the Bin Laden family had withdrawn their capital participation in the Carlyle Group. So remember those business connections, remember those names. Now, what I'm going to try to do, and forgive me for mumbling because I'm indulging in a few Ricola cough drops here to try to keep my vocal cords supple so that I can do the talk this evening and also do the program that I'm going to record tomorrow. As I noted when I spoke last February at Foothill, it'd be sort of ironic to be doing a lecture here and choke to death on a Ricola cough drop. You can imagine the headline, you know, conspiracy theorist chokes to death on a cough drop. That would I don't think many people would believe that, but if I sound like my dentures are loose, and I don't have dentures yet, it's because I'm trying to not necessarily walk and chew gum at the same time, but lecture and suck on a cough drop or chew a cough drop at the same time. So bear with me under the circumstances. Now, what we're going to do is try to trace some of the elements that we've been looking at and look at their development, and I hope that I will be able to do justice to illustrating the task of illustrating the connections between these people who could be considered collectively the elders of oil. And these are the politics of the elders of oil. And again, people say, well, I don't believe in conspiracy theory. Think of the term networking, because that's really what we're looking at. One of the names to remember is a guy named Jack Filby. Not a name most people know. He is the father of a famed British double agent who worked for the Soviets named Kim Philby. Jack Philby was also a British double agent working for a hostile foreign power. However, he was working with Nazi Germany. He had been active, along with Captain T.E. Lawrence, the famed Lawrence of Arabia. He'd been active in the British-sponsored Arab Legion that had been used as combatants against the Ottoman Turks in World War I. The Arab nations, as we now call them, were part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which dissolved at the end of World War I, and many people may have seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia. It's based in fact. And St. John, a.k.a. Jack Philby, was an associate of T.E. Lawrence, and he also was a British intelligencer who was a raving anti-Semite. He hated the Jews. And he had come to deeply resent the British. And when the British issued the Balfour Declaration, which basically represented a British endorsement for the concept of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, Kim Philby considered this to be a betrayal of the Arab cause and consequently also a concession to the people he hated, the Jews. And it should be noted that Jack Philby had formed a political alliance with a fellow named Ibn Saud, last name S-A-U-D, who was the head of an ultra-reactionary sect of Islam called the Wahhabis. That's spelled W-A-H-H-A-B-I. That is the sect of Islam that is now promulgated through Saudi Arabia. It was actually founded by a guy named Muhammad Wahhab, who lived to be a ripe old 89 years old, and he lived from 1703 to 1792, which was a pretty long lifespan for that period. And he was born in a section of what is now Saudi Arabia called Najd. That's spelled N-E-J-D. I'm not sure how that's pronounced. I do not speak Arabic. That is the current site of Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia. And interestingly enough, the Prophet Muhammad himself predicted that Najd would become a source of corruption and confusion in the future. anti-Wahhabi Muslims refer to Wahhabism as the trouble from Najd. And I'm not sure, I don't know the Arabic off the top of my head. But this is, it's important to understand in all of the discussion that's taking place about whether this is Muslim or not, or just what is the culpability of Islam, or in this entire debate that is, to a certain extent, focusing public discourse. It's worth understanding that as an article in the British Spectator, that's not to be confused with the American Spectator, but as a British, the British Spectator, this is noted in, For the Record 329, Wahhabism might be more accurately characterized as Islamo-fascism. It is not really representative of or characteristic of Islam. It is rather an extremely puritanical and very violent sect. And it has a strong historical relationship with international fascism. And that explicit Wahhabi-fascist alliance dates back to the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire and Jack Philby's sponsorship of Ibn Saud, who had led part of the British Arab Legion against the Ottoman Turks in World War I. Ultimately, Ibn Saud was set up with the connivance of Alan Dulles and Jack Philby as basically the head of what has come to be the modern Saudi kingdom. Saudi Arabia, in addition to having 25% of the world's proven oil reserves, also has the two holiest shrines in Islam, Mecca and Medina, within its borders. This was done very deliberately in order to attempt to corral, so to speak, the allegiance of Muslims to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And that, in turn, came under the control of the Arabian American Oil Company, American petroleum interests with an historical relationship with international fascism, and some elements that we're going to be tracing throughout this discussion of the politics of the elders of oil. Now, Ibn Saud was very close to a Yemeni immigrant who moved to what had become Saudi Arabia. Again, this was formerly part of the Ottoman Empire. Ibn Saud was the head of the Wahhabi sect. He had a very strong connection to Jack Philby and, as we're going to see, to international fascism. And in 1932, a Yemeni immigrant moved to Saudi Arabia and ultimately was to prosper in the construction business. His name was Mohammed bin Laden. He is the father of Osama bin Laden and also the founder of Saudi bin Laden, which is the construction company which has done most of the construction in Saudi Arabia following the oil boom. Now, in the pre-World War II period, the aforementioned Jack Philby and King Ibn Saud, who was a rabid anti-Semite, conspired with the person who had taken over Third Reich intelligence operations and covert operations in the Middle East, a guy named Otto von Bolschwing. That last name is capital V-O-N, capital B-O-L-S-C-H-W-I-N-G. Von Bolschwing was the superior of Adolf Eichmann, who led Hitler's extermination of the Jews. And he and Jack Philby worked out a sting plan in the pre-World War II and early World War II period in which Jack Philby, who was, remember, a British intelligence agent doubling on Britain on behalf not only of the Arabs but also for the Third Reich, Jack Philby, working with King Ibn Saud, approached the British and said that a very good way of securing Palestine for the United Kingdom might be for the British to promote Jewish emigration to Palestine in connection with the Balfour Declaration. The British thought that was a pretty good idea. All along, Jack Philby had planned on leaking this information to King Ibn Saud, and when the information about this emerged, this would, of course, generate outrage among the Palestinian Arabs. It would generate sentiment against the United Kingdom and against the Jews, and most importantly, on behalf of the Third Reich, on the part of not only Palestinian Arabs, but Arabs in general, thereby winning or stealing a march, I guess one could say, for the Third Reich in terms of corralling the Middle East's oil reserves. This ultimately was successfully realized. Von Bolschwing and Philby put together this sting. It ultimately was leaked to Ibn Saud and to the Arabs and resulted in a hardening of Arab sentiment against the United Kingdom, against the Jews, and on behalf of the Third Reich. It's also worth noting in this precise time period that the Third Reich was plotting with Ibn Saud and with a guy named Haj Amin al-Husseini, the self-proclaimed Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, and later a major in the SS. This is a name I've already discussed. But Ibn Saud and von Bolschwing and Haj Amin al-Husseini were plotting actively with the Third Reich in order to set up Ibn Saud as the head of what was known as the Caliphate. This was actually a term that dates back to the Ottoman Empire. Ibn Saud would be the head, in effect, of the entire Muslim world with the petroleum reserves of the Middle East, including and especially Saudi Arabia, corralled for the Third Reich. Haj Amin al-Husseini was going to become the top religious leader, basically the imam of the caliphate, and this was going to secure the Middle East for the Third Reich with the petroleum reserves of the Middle East. Ultimately, there were a number of factors that interfered with this, but even though ultimately, obviously due to the British military presence, the Third Reich was not able to secure the entire Middle East as the caliphate under the protection of Ibn Saud and with the cooperation actively of Haj Amin al-Husseini, ultimately the aforementioned Jack Filby, again, a British fascist, collaborator of Ibn Saud, and King Ibn Saud, and a guy who figures in this entire scenario in a very important way, Alan Dulles, a corporate lawyer for IG Farben, and a person who handled the holding company into which all of the Bush family pro-Third Reich holdings were folded. The Bush family, and where I'm going to, in a sense, jump back in time, the Bush family has an historical relationship with the Third Reich that dates back to 1924. That's when George Herbert Walker, George W.'s great-grandfather, whose last name he carries as a middle name, became involved with the Tucson family, again spelled T-H-Y-S-S-E-N, and the aforementioned George Herbert Walker, along with Fritz Thyssen and Henry Ford, the American industrialist, became one of the three earliest funders of Adolf Hitler. Later he incorporated his son-in-law, Prescott Bush Sr., the grandfather of George W. and the father of George Herbert Walker Bush, as one of his business partners in a number of pro-Nazi investments. 70% of the investment capital that went into Nazi Germany in the 1930s came from the United States. There were four major companies that operated on behalf of the Third Reich and for the Bush family. They were the Union Banking Corporation, the Hamburg America Line, the Seamless Tube Corporation, and also the Silesian American Corporation. All four were confiscated by the Alien Property Custodian in World War II as Nazi front companies. All four became part of the Harriman 15. That's Harriman as in Avril Harriman, another of the members of what some have termed the Wall Street Mafia. And when the heat, so to speak, as the true shape of Nazi Germany began to become clear to people, and as consequently investing in Nazi Germany became a bad PR move, Alan Dulles reorganized the Bush family Third Reich holdings into a holding company called the Harriman 15. That did not ultimately deter the Alien Property Custodian from confiscating them as Third Reich front companies. But it's important to understand that Alan Dulles was involved with the Bush family at this point, and that the Bush family was involved with the Third Reich at this point, and that Alan Dulles was involved with the Third Reich, and Alan Dulles was involved with King Ibn Saud, and Alan Dulles was involved with Jack Filby, and they were all involved with the Third Reich. Now, in this time period, Alan Dulles and Jack Filby and King Ibn Saud and the Third Reich worked out a deal, basically a three-way deal, in which oil was going to be shipped from Saudi Arabia to Franco's Spain, essentially or officially neutral, but actually operating on behalf of the Axis powers. And in turn, that was going to be transshipped to the Third Reich. This was profiting Alan Dulles. It was profiting Jack Filby. This was set up under the auspices of the Dillon Reed Company. What I'm going to do is, since we've got so many people arriving, and I didn't anticipate that this many people are going to show up, I'm going to I'm going to do something you're never going to see George W. do. I'm going to surrender my seat here. One of you...
Is there
one over there? This one is pre-warmed, by the way. The room is plenty warm, but this one has been sitting under my very own A blank blank here. So we've got a freshly warmed chair here. So if somebody wants a charge of 15 to get my chair here. And we've also got a number of printouts. They have arrived. Oh, and by the way, somebody in the back, take this and do so with my good blessings from the better part of my personality. Here we go. And I'm going to basically rough it. I'm going to stand and add to my burden. And again, I want to thank those of you who are arriving, and we're attempting to squeeze in here. It is deeply meaningful to see you show up on such short notice and under these conditions. And I alluded to some printouts of the For the Record programs 325 through 335, which I've done to date on the subject of 911. 329 on have been done since I left KFJC. All of the descriptions are now on the web, and there are printouts of these. So if people want to know, one of the questions I get asked a lot, and I always wonder about it, people say, well, where do you get your information? I would think that would be pretty clear when I do the program. I say, well, this is from this, you know, blah, 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 yakety, 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 yak. It should be pretty clear where I get my information from, not necessarily in a recapitulatable fashion, but one of the things that I've been doing is writing descriptions of the whole For the Record series for the web, and I've been footnoting them since June of 2000, and the footnoted descriptions with meticulous sourcing for all of the shows about 911 are on the web. Anybody anywhere in the world can access those, and there are copies of those available on the back table there, and they are for free. If people are wondering where to get that, you can get that from www.spitfirelist.com. For the Record section. And for late arrivals, we do have some people taping it. I was hoping to have a sound man here, but he did not arrive. So I will do my best to make the talks available, to make this talk available through Spitfire. Failing all else, the descriptions for everything that I have put on the web, that I've recorded so far about 911, are there with sourcing. So if you're wondering if some of this is going by too quickly, saying, you know, Ibn Saud, you know, saying, well, what? The sources are there, including page numbers, article titles, and the whole shooting match is there. Perhaps I should use a different term under the circumstances. Okay, back to the politics of the Elders of Oil, and we're going to move forward in time through the decades since World War II, and I'm going to trace some of these elements forward. In the late 1930s and leading up to World War II, I'm wondering, should we maybe try to scare up some more chairs? Do you think that's doable? Why don't you see if you can find something? In the early years of World War II, Ibn Saud, again, a good friend and business associate of Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, and Alan Dulles, a good friend of and political associate and business associate of the Bush family, and Jack Philby are conspiring to sell oil to the Third Reich. The oil is going to come from Saudi Arabia. It's going to go to Franco, Spain, transshipped there to the Third Reich. This was going to be done in cooperation with Texaco and with Standard Oil of California. Standard Oil of California eventually became known as Chevron. Those two companies had an exploration, a petroleum exploration company called Caltex. And in turn, the investment firm of Dillon Reed was heavily involved with this proposed deal. William Draper, Jr. of Dillon Reed, helped to administer many of the Third Reich investments, or many of the American investments in the Third Reich. He later was placed in charge of the American military government's economic section in terms of affecting the economic reconstruction of Germany, and saw to it that these business connections remained intact at the end of World War II. His son, William Draper III, helped to capitalize the younger George Bush's early business ventures. And by the way, his grandson, Tim Draper, wrote the school voucher initiative that failed in the fall of 2000. So he's a Silicon Valley player as well. So ultimately, this particular deal was arranged. It remains somewhat unclear as to what extent this was ultimately realized, because the records have not necessarily been completely disclosed. But bear in mind that Alan Dulles, associate of the Bush family, Ibn Saud, associate of the Third Reich, Jack Philby, and the Third Reich were conspiring, and Ibn Saud, of course, associate of Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, are conspiring to sell oil from Saudi Arabia to the Third Reich. And remember the role in this of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. We're going to come back to his situation later on in the talk as well. Remember also the name of Otto von Bolsheim. He was in charge of Third Reich intelligence operations in the Middle East. He was Adolf Eichmann's superior, and it was von Bolsheim who conspired with Jack Philby and Ibn Saud to sting the British and to basically help to drive the Arabs and their oil into the arms of the Third Reich. Now, I haven't got time to talk about all of the aspects of this particular concatenation. World War II, obviously, eventually the military hostilities came to a conclusion, and I'm going to try to telescope a number of events that took place in the 1950s and 1960s. At the end of World War II, of course, for all intents and purposes, the entire Nazi intelligence system was incorporated into the fledgling CIA under the auspices of Nazi intelligence chief of the Eastern Front, Reinhard Gehlen. Gehlen worked very closely in connection with the Muslim populations of the former Soviet Union with Haj Amin al-Husseini. That's the most unsavory component of the Gehlen CIA collaboration, was a very, very inappropriately named program that was conducted under the auspices of the State Department and the CIA, under the auspices of the Office of Policy Coordination. It was called the Crusade for Freedom. And what this entailed was the importation of Nazis, many of them war criminals of the most extreme stripe, in particular Central and Eastern European Nazi collaborators from some of the countries that eventually became part of the Warsaw Pact or Soviet bloc countries. And they were brought into the United States and set up as leaders in the Eastern European ethnic communities in the United States. Eventually, they were to evolve into a formal wing of the Republican Party, the Ethnic Outreach Organization. The person who oversaw the Crusade for Freedom was Alan Dulles. It was his godchild. The administration of it was handled by an up-and-coming lawyer named Richard Nixon, who, of course, was to go on and become president of the United States. The person who was the chief spokesperson for the Crusade for Freedom was Ronald Reagan, and the fellow handling the State Department machinations for the Crusade for Freedom was William Casey, a close associate of the Bush family, later chairman of the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980, ultimately director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the person under whose auspices CIA collaborated with the elder George Bush in the Iran-Contra affair. One of the people brought to the United States under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom was Otto von Bolsheim, one of the top SS officials in charge of the liquidation of the Jews. He ultimately settled in California. He set up an electronics company called TCI, which was present in the Silicon Valley. It was based in Sacramento. They had a subsidiary named International Imaging Systems, which was located in Mountain View. One of the people who was a protege of Otto von Bolsheim and who worked for TCI was a woman named Helena von Dahm. Remember that name, because we're going to come back to that. TCI, International Imaging Systems, and Helena von Dahm in the future. Now, at the end of World War II, the elder George Bush graduated from Yale. He was a member of Skull and Bones. He went to work for the oil industry, and apparently under the auspices of that, also for the Central Intelligence Agency. The company that he went to work for was the largest oil field drilling operation in the world, at that exploration company in, at that time, and I believe it still is, although it's now been folded into another company called Halliburton Oil, the CEO of which was Dick Cheney, who is now, of course, Vice President of the United States, and also in charge of the counter-terrorist operations of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The person who basically secured for the elder George Bush his position with Dresser Industries was Alan Dulles, again an associate of Prescott Bush Sr., and a close associate of Prescott Bush Sr., who was also a member of Skull and Bones, named Henry Neal Mallon, who was the head of Dresser Industries. I would also note at this time, in the 1950s, just as the Third Reich's capital organization had gone underground under the direction of the Bormann Group and the remarkable and deadly Martin Bormann, so too the intelligence outfit of the Third Reich had continued to function. The real head of that was Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo. But one of the very interesting aspects of the operations of the Galen organization was that it in many ways served simply as a front for the Odessa, for the post-World War II SS underground. In the 1950s, Gamal Abdel Nasser, a colonel in the Egyptian army, effected the overthrow of King Farouk, who was a British protege in Egypt. This was accomplished in considerable measure with the assistance of the Odessa, the Bormann organization, the Mueller organization. And when Colonel Nasser came to power, the CIA wanted to get a foot in, so to speak, in Nasser's Egypt. They did not want to... they wanted to basically try to win Nasser over to a pro-American and anti-Soviet position. Because of the American association with Israel, they did not want to send regular CIA agents. So what they did was they contacted Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo and the security director for the Bormann organization, and he in turn contacted the number one operative of the Odessa, who was SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, one of the most important figures. He was in charge of commando training for the Third Reich. And Skorzeny led a mission into Egypt.